Don't adjust the television set. Your reception's fine, but in their new suburban home, the Freeling family has tuned into something beyond our world. Poltergeist. You'll never look at your television set the same way again. Poltergeist, a Steven Spielberg production, rated PG.
Now playing at a theater near you, check newspapers.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 6 of Hanging with Toby Hooper, the podcast about all things Toby Hooper. I am one of your Hanging with Toby Hooper co-hosts, Patrick Bromley, joined as always by my Hanging with Toby Hooper co-host, my horror BFF, Heather Wixon. Hi, Heather.
Hello. I feel like I should start it off with like saying like they're here, but
that would be
I
hacky.
Couldn't really work that in, right?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not original, you know. In fact, I was actually just planning for this episode just to read my chapter from start to finish.
Please do. It will kill a lot of time and it might move some books.
Yeah, there you go. So double win.
I felt so bad because we were having a birthday party for our daughter yesterday and people were very nice and they were asking about the book and about the signing. And we had some friends who were here from out of town and they don't see movies or know much about movies, and I was explaining, oh yeah, the signing was great, it was me and my co-author Heather, and then there were a bunch of like directors and actors and people from 80s horror that were there, and he said, oh, did you have the little girl from Poltergeist? And I was like, oh no.
Right. No,
why'd you
oh,
have to
gosh.
Lead with that one
out of everybody,
right?
Oh,
could have said Freddy,
dear.
But I don't even know if you know.
That's what I was. That would have been my like right? Go-to, right?
Did you have Freddy? Well, no, we didn't. But at least Robert Englund is still with us.
Oh boy, that's rough.
Well, this is a very exciting episode of Hanging with Toby Hooper because last episode we got to do the Funhouse, which is my favorite Toby movie. And now we get to do the Poltergeist. What the fuck is wrong with me? Now we get to do Poltergeist, which is your favorite Toby movie.
It is my favorite Toby movie. I'm so excited. I mean, for a long time, it was really neck and neck between like Poltergeist and Salem's Lot for me.
Okay.
But I would say probably the more I watch Poltergeist, the more time I spend with Poltergeist, especially getting to write about it for the In Search of Darkness book. I figured maybe in that conversation, I should say the title of the book we were talking about.
Oh, good point.
Yeah.
You mean the one that's available at aminkpublishing.com?
That is correct. And you can buy it directly there. Not available on Amazon or other retailers because it is a limited run, which I think we're under 200 copies left.
Well, that's going to change as soon as this podcast drops because 200 people are going to buy it and then we can start talking about the paperback.
Nice. Or the sequel, because apparently that's a thing too.
I'm into it.
Yeah. Everybody was coming in like, so when are you writing about the rest of the movies from the documentaries? And I was like, Oh dear God, please just give me a moment. I was like, you have no idea what this was like. I need it's like half the movies, but still like
Right.
I need a breather. Like,
Yeah.
let me go on vacation first and then we'll talk about this, you know. Because holy cow. Yeah, it was a lot. Which was a nice it was a nice thing though. I appreciate that. I love that people have enthusiasm for this and I've really enjoyed what we've done with it. So,
Yeah.
but yeah, like for me, like Poltergeist is just, it's perfect and I love it. And I'm so excited to talk about it because it's weird. There's so many movies that I'm really intimidated to write about. Poltergeist is never even one of those, but it feels like it should be.
Okay.
So I'm excited that we get to dive into it for this because I'm always finding sort of like new little things to discuss. So yay for today.
Love it. Years ago, on the 1 year anniversary of Tobe Hooper's passing, at F This Movie, we did an all day live tribute to Tobe Hooper, and you came on close to the end of the tribute. And we talked about Poltergeist for a while. I don't remember anything we said. So this discussion is basically going to be brand new.
I could not tell you a one thing we said either.
Right?
No. But here's I found my superpower. I can't tell you anything about that. But you know what I realized is the other night that I still know every single word to Foolish Beat from Debbie Gibson. Like I was listening to it yesterday.
Well, that works out
Yeah.
because on this
We're gonna
episode,
talk
you're
about
going to
this.
do a dramatic reading of Foolish Beat by Debbie Gibson.
Don't tempt me with a good time, Bromley, because I will. No, it was funny. Like, so things have been really overwhelming at work. And honestly, at night, like, I don't get home till at least 8 o'clock. I have to eat dinner and I need to like decompress. And I'm still kind of like cleaning up stuff in like my personal emails, trying to get some work stuff done. And so honestly, I've just been throwing on, we have Vevo channels on our Sling. So I just kind of go back and forth between the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. And the other night, Foolish Beat came on, a song I genuinely have not heard since I was in middle school. And somehow I knew every single lyric. And Brian was laughing at me so hard. He's like, what? How do you even? I was like, until you have been a preteen girl with a crush, you will never understand the power of Foolish Beat and why that shit will stick with you for decades. So good on you, Debbie Gibson. You gave us all the heartbreak anthem we needed for the late 80s.
I just want to back up for 1 second because I feel like we take language for granted in that we say things nowadays that 5 years ago wouldn't have meant anything because you very casually threw out, we have Vevo channels on our Sling, as though that is a sentence that people should understand, right? And I think everybody does, but like, if you actually back up and listen to what we're saying, it's gibberish.
It is gibberish, yes. For those who may not understand, Vevo is kind of like the music video platform that you'll see on YouTube. And Sling is sort of like the alternative to like regular cable. So it's like a little cheaper and everything like that. And they add like specialty channels, like there's a Price is Right channel. It's kind of like the version, it's like a little bit more of an upgrade from Pluto,
Okay.
in terms of like it has licensed stuff and like new TV and all that. So it has a kind of a mixture of like classic and new TV. But yeah, they actually have like a bunch of different Vevo channels where you can just watch music videos constantly. They've been doing a lot of Bon Jovi lately, which is weird. It's probably because of the documentaries on Hulu. But yeah, so you know, at least I didn't talk about my TiVo or something and like date myself. And then I got a page on my beeper.
Is Pluto or Sling where you watch your 90210 Melrose Place channel?
It was Pluto. That was what
Okay.
really got me through COVID,
Okay.
because we didn't actually have Sling yet.
Okay.
The only reason we ended up getting Sling was just because just kind of keeping up with like live wrestling.
Ah, got it.
Yeah. And but Pluto was really got us through like 6 months, and it was just nice to be able to have 90210 in Melrose Place. And then it was also like they don't show certain episodes and things like that. So then I had to try to start to fill some gaps with Hulu. Still found out through everything that there are certain episodes that just don't air on either, and it was a whole big thing. So then I ended up giving up on 90210. One of these days, I want to buy the box set for myself.
Is the
But I
episode
just,
on the DVD?
it's not in
Okay.
the box set. So
Okay.
they like change music. Like you can't, like they don't air the Color Me Bad episode of 90210,
Okay. Is that because
which is
nobody
it.
wants to remember Color Me Bad?
Bite your tongue, Patrick. I loved Color Me Bad. I
Did
still
you
love,
really?
I do. I still listen to Color. It's on my Spotify playlist. Are you
Oh
kidding?
boy.
I know. I am nothing but a basic bitch. But no, seriously, yeah, I think it's just music rights and stuff like that. I think
Okay.
there's an episode with Babyface that also doesn't get aired either for similar reasons. Because they don't want to pay Babyface mu music royalties or something like that. So
No, none of us do.
yeah. So yeah,
We should
it's a
mention
whole.
most of 90210 was directed by Toby Hooper, which is why we're talking about it on this Toby Hooper podcast.
Course. Oh, did we go down a pizza rabbit hole here, Patrick? We have to get back to
We're
Poltergeist.
talking
Sorry,
about
everybody.
TV, and you can't talk about TV without talking about Poltergeist. Or is it
Right.
the other way
It's
around? You can't talk about Poltergeist without talking about TV. Fuck, I always mess that
I think it's the second one. I think you're correct.
up.
And in fact, I have it playing right now in the background, and Carol Ann is in the kitchen with her face almost pressed up against the tiny TV on the counter.
Nice.
Yes, I like to keep the movie on, just kind of rolling in the background when we talk. I don't know, it just makes me feel more immersed.
I messed up. I put the remake on.
Oh no, I've never seen it. Is it okay?
I saw it opening day. I couldn't tell you two things about it. No, it's not okay. It's not good.
Oh, okay. I never knew. I was, I mean, it wasn't for me, so I was like, I don't need
Yeah,
it. I'm
I wanted
cool.
to review it,
Sorry,
so I
Sam
went to see
Rockwell.
it. Right. He's good, and I'm a fan of. Holy shit. Rosemary DeWitt. I was
Obviously.
not coming up with it. Rosemary DeWitt. I think she's really good in everything. They go into the further at one point using like a drone. It's not a good movie. But let's talk
No.
about what is a good movie, which is Poltergeist from 1982, released June 4th, 1982. Here is the user summary from IMDb. It reads, "A young family are visited by ghosts in their home. At first, the ghosts appear friendly, moving objects around the house to the amusement of everyone. Then they turn nasty and start to terrorize the family before they kidnap the youngest daughter."
I want to hug that user for that very like cutesy way of describing Poltergeist.
It really is like kidnap is in quotes, by the way.
Oh, that's
Yeah.
fun.
Yeah.
Also, it's worth pointing out that Steve was not amused at the beginning.
No.
He was never amused by any of this.
No.
My favorite description of it actually is on Vudu, because that's we have a digital version of it because we have the 4K,
Ooh.
and it says how the Freelings are moving into a new house and encounter ghosts. And I was like, wow, you guys missed the point of what the entire movie is about, like by a landslide. So Vudu slash Fandango at home, if you're listening, I am available to rewrite a lot of your movie descriptions. My favorite also too is when I put on Nightmare 1, it's a still from Nightmare 2. It's Mark Patton screaming at his Freddy glove hand in the shower. There's work to be done, and I'm here to do it if anybody wants me,
That's a
is what
very
I'm saying.
obvious one. I like even I would spot that. That's not like Freddy has the stripes on his sleeves, which you so cannily observed recently. Mark Patton screaming into the glove. Anybody who knows horror movies would know that that's not from Nightmare One.
Yeah, it's an adorable quirk of voodoo for me. So, yeah, but I think when did you, because I think I've probably been living with Poltergeist a little bit longer than you have. When did you first see Poltergeist?
I definitely saw it as a kid, because I remember being fairly traumatized by the guy pulling his face off. Like the clown stuff didn't bother me. Nothing in the movie really got to me except for the guy peeling off his own face. And that was sort of my memory of Poltergeist all the way into adulthood because I didn't see it for years and years and years until probably after F this movie started, and I did a podcast on it like the first year of F this movie. So we're going back like 13, 14 years.
40
And
years now?
yeah, basically. And I watched it and liked it, but I remember on that podcast saying, like, this isn't my Tobe Hooper movie. And it's still not my number one, but I was overly dismissive of it 13 years ago because it's a movie that I like way more every single time I see it. I'm amazed at how good it is.
It's funny because, like, for me, like, Poltergeist was such an integral part of my childhood
yeah
that, like, I kind of just don't remember not knowing Poltergeist because I didn't, my mom didn't take me to see it in theaters, but my neighbor had rented it in 83, I want to say. I know I wasn't six yet because it was before my birthday. And then I remember getting my Cabbage Patch Kid doll when I turned six and being slightly afraid because she sort of had hair like the clown in Poltergeist. So I connected them with those then. I remember that. And then I would just kind of like watch her a little bit, and then she didn't ever move during. So we were cool. And her arms are shorter. So, you know, I was in no real danger. So I know I saw it before I was six, and I just, it was a thing that like scared the absolute shit out of me as a little kid. But I was so fascinated by it because it felt like horror that shouldn't really be for kids. But yet it still felt really accessible. Like everything about it just felt like I could walk into the Freelings' house and I was part of it. I don't know if that makes any sense, especially being a kid. But it just felt like like this sort of really nice invitation into like horror in a way that a lot of movies really weren't at the time.
Well, I think that's part of the function of Poltergeist, which is to make the horror accessible, A, by virtue of the PG rating and the produced by Steven Spielberg of it all, because in the 80s, that was essentially a brand that welcomed families to check a movie out. But also this idea, you know, and you and I are both kids who grew up in the northwest suburbs of Chicago, by moving horror out to sort of the ordinary suburbs, it makes it more accessible because we hadn't really seen horror movies that took place in houses like the ones that we recognized, whether it was our house, a friend's house, whatever. Horror was reserved for, you know, the Bates Motel or the house
teenagers
they live in the Omen, or right, teenagers
making bad decisions
at a summer camp. I mean, obviously, the horror moves out to the suburbs later in the 80s with stuff like A Nightmare on Elm Street or whatever. But in 82, Poltergeist was sort of quietly revolutionary in that way.
Yeah. One of the things that like I wrote about this, I think this was for the 30th anniversary, maybe.
You're never going to keep it straight because you've written about this movie so many goddamn times.
Yeah. Maybe it was the 35th, but I wrote this thing like, because to me, I was a kid who grew up in a trailer park, which was something I grew up really ashamed of. I sort of wear it as a badge of honor now because I realized that that was just a bunch of assholes' opinions shaping who I was more so than what they actually knew about my childhood and how we grew up. But for me, I think what made Poltergeist so scary is because the Freelings literally are the American dream. Like they're the thing that everybody was aspiring to achieve in the 80s. Like we're coming through Reaganomics and everything like that. And I'm not getting political, but there was a socioeconomical thing going on at the time.
Of course.
Where, you know, it was very much, you were seeing a lot of sort of the folks coming out of like the Vietnam War era, the Woodstock era, and they were kind of double era, settling down into the suburbs, starting families, taking like corporate jobs. It's kind of seemed almost like the antithesis of what their lives were 10 years prior. So it was really fascinating. And I think that's one of the interesting things that Poltergeist does in terms of like sort of, it taps into this in so many different kind of horrors. It taps into this horror of your parents, you can't keep your kids safe.
Right.
And they get taken. It taps into, you've worked so hard at a job that you really believed in, and you find out, oh shit, all of that is a lie, and it's really scary and really deceptive in terms of what they've done. It taps into the, oh, you're going to move to the suburbs to keep your family safe and build this life, and that's all a lie too. Like, there's so many different things, and also too that your childhood when you're a kid is just kind of scary because like these things that are supposed to be inherently fun are actually kind of freaky, like weird clown dolls.
Right. Yeah,
So
I
that
think.
for me, it's like everything. Like it encompasses so many great different things. So
Well,
sorry, I'll
it's.
shut up.
No. Please don't shut up. We have a lot of time to fill. It's impressive that the horror movie, the horror of the movie works for kids because you can watch it through the eyes of Heather O'Rourke or, Oliver Robbins and like be horrified by things like the clown doll. But the older you get, the more you identify with the Freeling parents, and the more you realize like how, kind of sophisticated and mature the themes of the movie are, and it's not just like kiddie funhouse shit, which is what it feels like as a kid, which is fine. That's not a knock against the movie. That's your way into the movie. But that it works on all ages because at every age, it's speaking to you in a different way. And I, even Nightmare on Elm Street, which is like my favorite horror movie, I'm still not at the point where I'm identifying with the Thompson parents, right? I watch that movie and I'm still Nancy. But the Freelings are so different because. It helps, I'm sure, that I have kids of my own, and so I identify with like what lengths would I go to protect them and that kind of shit. But I think even if you don't have kids, there's so much about the Freelings that you do identify with as you grow older. I think it's rare that a horror movie can really shift your perspective like that and still work as well, if not even better.
Yeah, totally. And I also think what's interesting too is like you were talking about sort of coming at it from the perspective of kids. And what I like about like Poltergeist and how it sort of even ties into like stuff that we see in like the Funhouse or even in Eaten Alive, like you have a child that's in the mix of those movies, like with like Joey in the Funhouse, and like he sort of stumbles across like not so great circumstances, right? And just he sneaks out like he, you know what I mean? Like his parents don't even know he's gone at first. And I think what's really cool is like Poltergeist shows that even when your kids are at home and you know where they are, they're still not safe.
Right.
So you kind of almost see this progression through these different Toby movies where it's like being a parent is like one of the most terrifying and trying jobs you can ever have. Because ultimately sometimes there's just nothing you can do.
Right.
And
Right.
that's real terror.
Absolutely. Let me ask you something about the Freelings. Years ago, there's a podcast that I listened to called Screen Drafts, and two of the guest GMs on the episode were Chelsea Stardust and Sean Keller, who are married in real life. And they were drafting against another couple, maybe, and I apologize for not remembering who the other couple was, but the subject of the show was relationship horror. Now, there's no way that it was defined. There was no box in which that term was being kept. It was just called relationship horror. So it was a lot of like Possession and The Shining and like what happens when your relationship goes wrong and you turn on each other and how is that horrifying? But Chelsea and Sean at number two tried to draft Poltergeist, saying that if we're going to look at the horror of potential horror of relationships, we should also be looking at an example of a great relationship and that Poltergeist doesn't exist without the bond between the Freelings. And the other couple shot it down and said, no, it's not, that doesn't qualify as relationship horror. I'm just wondering what your take is.
I am very much in disagreement with that. I mean, the reason we care so much about Poltergeist is all of these relationships. And it truly is Steve and Diane that like get you through this experience, because there's even the moment when Diane's about to go through to the other side, to tie into the sequel, if you will, which Patrick wrote about in the In Search of Darkness book.
Not an easy chapter to write, let me tell you.
I know. I know. I love the Brayson scene though. Anyway, but there's a thing where she's like, when she's like, Steven, don't let go. And there is so much power and weight in that one simple line where you know the devotion that these two characters have towards each other and towards their family. I'd be he I'm so against the idea that Steve and Diane aren't like what you'd want out of a good horror relationship. Like, that blows my mind that you would that anybody would shoot that down,
Yeah, I
because that
wanted to
for me
like
they
turn
were
it off.
peak.
I was exactly like if that's if you're talking about relationships in horror movies, which ostensibly is what the draft was, it wasn't just when relationships go bad. I understand that's a different draft, but like relationships in horror movies, this is the model.
Oh, it absolutely is. And it's so crucial. Like, I mean, here's the thing. You don't have, if that relationship doesn't matter, you don't have the scene with them in the bed or on the bed smoking weed. He, you know, Steven's reading his Reaganomics book. And they're, you know, just talking about like Carolyn's, it, you know, sort of her premonitions, if you will, because Diane's already tuning into the fact that there's something very special about her daughter. And this is parents who are very much, they're having their time, but their time is also involving their family, and it's also involving them connecting as a couple. And I think it's crucial. It wasn't that, you know, some scenes, like some movies might have done a sex scene there, and I'm so not anti-sex scenes, but I love that it's just a conversation between two parents just sort of hanging out in the moment.
Definitely.
Because for me, that like naturalism to that scene, like, adds so much to like the, oh God, this sounds so cheesy, but like the tapestry of the story of Poltergeist.
Ooh,
This is why
tapestry.
we, you like that, right? That's why we give a shit when Caroline goes missing, and this family is obviously going through this torment, what that's like physical, it's mental, it's emotional. Like, they are going through it in this movie. But they're not gonna give up until they get their kid back, you know? And if you don't like, if you don't care about what they're experiencing and the things that they're dealing with on a personal level, then literally it's just a movie that's got some really cool special effects. And they are very cool, visual and practical. So,
Absolutely. How did
and
Jo Beth Williams not receive an Oscar nomination for the movie?
honestly, like, how did Zelda Rubinstein not get one either? And you can't even argue about the screen time either, because like her, I think her screen time is like 5.5 minutes in the entire movie, maybe 6.5. Where Judi Dench is in Shakespeare in Love for what, 7 minutes? And gets a nom and also gets a win, doesn't she?
Didn't Beatrice Straight win for Network, and she's in possibly even less? Or am I thinking of the wrong person?
I'm not
No,
sure
she
in
was.
that
She
one.
was in Network, the shortest ever. She's in 5 minutes and 2 seconds of the movie.
Yeah, so I mean,
Speaking
for
of
it,
Poltergeist.
speaking of Poltergeist, turning that right back around. Yeah, no, Jo Beth, like, you know, it's interesting, because I'm guessing the clout that's the Spielberg name has today wasn't there back then. I think he was still a director that was viewed as making popcorn movies, even from a producer standpoint. And I get it. The Academy is the Academy, whatever. But yeah, there is no way you watch Jo Beth's performance in this movie and not connect to her on some emotional level. Like, I mean, this sounds hyperbolic, and it isn't, because I'm a weird person who fixates on stuff. But I would say my viewings of Poltergeist are definitely in the hundreds. I don't know if I've hit the 200, but it's in the hundreds range. And every single time that that moment hits, when she gets hit by the gust of air, and she looks at Beatrice Straight and she's like, she moved through my soul, like, and I still tear up. Like, like, that is such a movie, like, again, it's such a small, quiet thing. It's not this big boisterous, look at me Oscar performance. It's so like just in the moment. Like she's phenomenal. And I mean, I honestly, I think Craig T. Nelson, there's a lot of things that he does in this movie that are really understated, especially when the shit hits the fan, that I don't think he gets enough credit for. Just the way he's like almost constantly assessing the situation and trying to come at it from a different perspective than his wife, but not in a way that's like against what she thinks,
No,
because she's,
he's a
yeah,
skeptic, but he's not contradicting
stupid.
her. He's not
Yeah, he
dismissing her.
knows.
He's not gaslighting her. Right. He's just a skeptic, you know, in a way that she isn't. And I think the movie is, whether it's trying to make this point or whether it's playing into a point that often gets made in our society that, you know, the bond between a mother and her children is different than the bond between a father and their children. I think this movie is definitely running with that idea, you know, and I don't knock the movie for that. I'm not saying it's a fault of the movie just because I am a father. I think it's just saying, no, their roles are different. They serve different functions. And it's one of the reasons they work as a couple, you know, because they
Yeah.
approach it differently, and it's kind of beautiful.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's like, you know, even like in the scene where like pardon me, I just sipped coffee and it went down the wrong pipe. But when Tangina comes in and she's like, oh, you know, and she's talking to them and like, you know, who does the discipline in your house? You could even see the hesitation where it's like, yes, Steven does it, but does he really do it? You know, and it's just it's there's just so much like layered in to the family and the dynamics of this movie that I think is just again what makes it so special. Like if you look even at like the opening sequence, and I think again that's something I talked about in that article I wrote about like the American Dream and how this sort of deconstructs it. The opening scene when like the dog is walking through the house and like you get the sense of like the geography of the house, the characters. And then Caroline comes down to the TV and Steven's sleeping on the chair. When they come down the stairs, like look at the way that those characters are all posed, between everybody. Like Caroline is like right there in the forefront, and she's within the family dynamics, like she's the focus point. She's the one that everybody is kind of focused on. She becomes the one that everybody's looking for in the movie. And then Steven's right there. And typically it probably would be the mom would be next. And not that Diane isn't connected to her, but I think that there's something like with, you know, when he, like, when even when he calls her Sweet Pea, like, there's just something. And I really love that for one of the rare instances in horror, like, we see the dad almost positioned before the mom. And then on the staircase is Diane. Oh my gosh, why am I blanking? How do I blank on anything? With Dana. And then poor Robbie is in the back because he's the middle kid and he gets lost in the mix a little bit. And, you know, and we see that sort of even play into Poltergeist 2 a little bit as well. Poor Robbie, like, is, man, middle kid syndrome is just the worst for him. Like, he really goes through it. So, yeah, I mean, there's so many interesting, like, dynamics that go on. Without the movie even like having to sit down and be like, okay, this is how this family is. Like it's just layered in there. It's just part of it. And again, I think that's why it works as well as it does 40, almost 42 years later.
Is you've seen the movie more times than me, and maybe this is addressed in the movie, and I've managed to miss it every time I've seen it. Is Dana a child from a previous marriage?
No, I'm guessing based on the age, because when Steve's doing the interview and he says, oh, Diane's 31, nope, 32. I'm guessing Diane got pregnant as a teen. Does that, I don't know if that means that she is Steve's child or not, or you know what I mean? Like maybe they hooked up in high school and then just ended up getting married and doing their whole thing, because that's the thing that used to happen a lot back then. But yeah, it's obvious sort of from that little note that I think that Dana was like a uh-oh, I think we've got a situation, but I also have homeroom. What are we gonna do? So yeah, I've always wondered, like, because that to me, I'm like, wait, she's 16 and Diane's 32.
Right.
I'm no math scholar, but
So I always read that as like, oh, she's Steven's daughter from a previous
he's not that much
relationship.
older though, because he's like 37, isn't he?
Sure.
Yeah, I think that's what his age is when he gets in his. So, I mean, I'm guessing he might have just been like somebody older in high school, or I don't know, because she, I mean, they never really explicitly say.
Right.
I'm just going to say, in my mind, just based on this relationship that they have, like, she was like, uh-oh, I think we have a situation here.
Sure.
Okay, we're going to go get married and go start life in the suburbs.
It's amazing that the movie never addresses it. It doesn't make it a worse movie, but I just know if this movie gets made in 2024, we're for sure explaining like how that's possible.
Yeah, I mean the thing is too, like I guess my whole thing is like screenwriters maybe should have just like made Diane like 34.
Yeah, right. Nobody
You
would
know, just
question it, right?
or make Dana 15 instead of
Right.
16.
Yeah.
You know, just do a little fudging of the math. I mean maybe there was like a whole subplot. I've never seen anything really explain that aspect of the story more. But if anybody out there by any chance knows that, that'd be cool. I wish Toby was here to tell us more. But yeah, that's always something that's kind of stuck out to me as well.
One of the things that Poltergeist does, and I apologize because I'm jumping all over the place, but one of the things that
It's all right.
Poltergeist does that very few movies successfully do, the other one that pops into my head is Aliens. James Cameron's Aliens kind of does something similar. And there are other Tobe Hooper movies that do this as well, is that structurally, it takes you to a logical concluding point. And you sort of breathe a sigh of relief and you say, okay, the movie's over. The nightmare has ended. And it's like being on a roller coaster and going up a one last drop, and you're like, okay, I'm done. And you let your guard down, only to find out there's another huge drop after that. Poltergeist, you know, ostensibly concludes and then goes on for 10 or 15 more minutes of horrifying shit. And it's brilliant the way that it's structured, because it does lull you into a false sense of security and then continue. I mean, even Texas Chainsaw Massacre sort of does it in terms of like that Last Supper sequence. You sort of think is it's not to the extent that Poltergeist does it, but that Last Supper sequence, you kind of feel like once Sally gets away, it's done, but then there's another chase with Leatherface. Tobe Hooper is great. You know, I don't remember his exact quote, but he talks about how he feels like horror should always go for the throat. And the structure of Poltergeist, particularly in that last act, where instead of being a three-act movie, it's more like a four-act movie or a five-act movie. He really goes for the throat in that last sequence, and I just think it's an amazing achievement, and not enough movies do it, and maybe that's what makes it work. If more movies did it, we might start to expect it. So the fact that very few movies do it and do it as successfully as Poltergeist does makes it stand out and feel special.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, a lot of my favorite movies do that sort of thing. Like, I think, like if you look at like Nightmare 3, like, oh, we've come through it. Oh, everything's great. Oh, I've passed over Nancy. Let me give you a ghost hug from Ghost Dad over here. And then, oh shit, it's actually Freddy. He's now killed Nancy. Kristen's gonna have to deal with this. And then, oh, you know what I mean? Like,
Yeah.
yeah, I'm all in on that. And I think what I love about it, like, and how it works in Poltergeist or even Aliens, and like it makes the threat feel even bigger in a lot of ways, because just because you get your kid back in the case of Poltergeist doesn't mean like that there's not weird supernatural entities still around. Like,
Right.
you're still living on a house that's basically been built on top of a cemetery. There's still wrongness in the space that you're inhabiting. And sure, you're moving, but you should have just left in that moment. Like, the fact that they even slept there one night blows my mind. I'm out. Like I get my kid back from the other realm and I'm gone. Like I'm moving. That's we're done. I can send people to pack my stuff up. It's not that important.
Right.
I don't need anything in that house as much as I would need my family. And it just it, and I like that it does that. And I think the same thing with aliens. Like, you come through and you're like, oh, I'm Ripley and I made it through. And then it's like, oh no, here you go. This thing is like, it's powerful. It gives it like more resonance. Like, that we're no matter what you do, like, yeah, you're gonna fight this, but you're there's it's the threat is always gonna be there.
Right.
Because like, and I think especially like in the case of like the alien universe, it's like, yeah, okay, you're gonna kill this one xenomorph or whatever, but like, you think that's it? You think that's it in the entire universe? Like there's nothing else out there that's coming for you. And I
Right.
also think too that like in the aliens universe that they've always just sort of like focused on like one sort of species mostly. When I'm like, we know that there's millions, like there's so many other things out there, like,
Yeah.
I want to see xenomorphs have to battle with like other aliens, like getting in the mix. Like,
Like predators?
well, like not on Earth though. I guess you know what I mean, but like something new even. Like
Yes.
I'm all about alien versus predator. Don't get me wrong.
Right, well, it's because that's your boy, right? Isn't that
I know. I'm one of the team defenders.
PWSA?
It is. But I mean, even like something in like the new Alien movie, like we got all the crazy facehuggers going bananas, but like give me something like crazy weird that like the facehuggers are like, wait, what is this?
Yeah.
What do I, you know what I mean? Like, so I'm all about that kind of stuff because I think for me, especially like for those of us who watch a lot of movies and we're sort of conscientious of these things and like that 3X structure, mix that shit up. I'm not, I don't watch movies because they have to hit a numbers quotient for me. You want
Yeah.
to give me 5X? Give me 5X. I don't care.
As long as it all
Like,
works, yeah.
yeah, I mean, exactly. As long as I'm entertained and I'm having a good time, you could screw structure for all I care too. As long as it works in the service of the story you're trying to tell.
I'm so
But
glad
yeah,
you.
that,
Go
oh,
ahead.
go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just gonna say that third act, that sort of tech, like that three act three and a half,
Yeah.
is what I love about it is like you literally could just like it that for me is the roller coaster beyond anything else because everything else is like you have to go in it almost feels really subdued in a way in comparison to everything that happens from that moment on because
Yeah.
it's like all of a sudden it's not just we're going to take your kid to the other realm now we're manifesting in ways inside your house and what are you going to do about it and why are
Yeah.
you even still here.
Right. I'm so glad you mentioned the building the house on the cemetery because we should point out at this point a common misconception about Poltergeist is that the house was built on a Native American burial ground, and it is not. That stuff doesn't come into the movie until the sequels. The house in Poltergeist is simply built on a cemetery where they
Yeah.
moved the headstones, but not the bodies.
Yeah, I mean even oh my gosh, why can't I think of his even Teague says when they're scoping out the new property area, he's like, it's not like we're buying not like we're
Oh,
building on
yeah.
top of ancient, tribal burial ground.
Right,
So
right,
he even says that they're not.
right.
It is a very much a cemetery. So I think people just get a little confused,
It's
which is
become one
sort
of
of
those
funny.
Mandela effect things where everybody just sort of believes that
Where's
in,
it?
yeah, that in Poltergeist that they was built on the a cemetery full of indigenous people, but that is not the case.
No, I mean, I don't know why they go the directions that they go further in these films,
I have
but
so many questions about, particularly
I don't know.
Poltergeist 2. I actually like 3. I think 3 is pretty cool. I
I
wish it
do
was
think three is
not a
pretty
Poltergeist
cool.
sequel. You know, I think it could have just been an amazing horror movie in a high rise. And 3 was hard to write about, obviously, because of the Heather O'Rourke stuff. But it was easy to write about in terms of like, this is a cool movie and the effects are amazing and Gary Sherman rules. 2 was a lot harder because it's like, I like all this stuff in theory. I like all these people. I like Poltergeist. What went wrong?
Yeah, I think for me, like the one thing, like there are a few good set pieces in that movie. The scene in the car is really great. I think the braces sequence to me was like nightmare. fuel for me because I remember I was supposed to get braces as a kid. We couldn't afford it, so I never got them. But I just remember like thinking like, oh, I don't want braces. I'm gonna get freaking and you know, in mummified in braces if I get braces. I don't want that. But I think Reverend Kane, I think is for me the saving grace of that movie that helps me not mind the rest of it as much. There, but yeah, it so pales in comparison to its predecessor. That it's hard to make a case for it. Because it's missing so much of what the made the first movie work. Because I think you're genuinely missing that connection. And I think, again, this speaks to when you're talking about the screen drafts thing, I think you're really missing the connection between Steve and Diane. And they just feel so disconnected as characters here. And I get it, marriages have those moments. But then you have these characters fighting through, but you don't really feel why.
Well,
And I think
and
that's where you're kind of missing that.
you're handicapping yourself by undermining your greatest asset, you know, like what makes Poltergeist as great as it is beyond the scares and the set pieces and the sort of horror elements is at its heart is that it's this story about a family. And this family that really loves each other, and this family that will do anything for each other, and that trickles down from the parents who are in love and will do anything for each other and to each other, and down to the kids. And then in Poltergeist 2, it's like everyone is unpleasant and not, you know, they turn Steven against everyone. I think it's handicapped from the outset.
Yeah, no, I do not disagree. And the thing is too, like I do appreciate how it does sort of explore this idea of like, you know, shit's getting pretty intense, you know, you're trying to provide for your family, take care of them. Things are not working out. You know, you're not working. You have no insurance because they're not going to like pay your claim.
Right.
And so he turns to alcohol to try to cope and what that can do to a family. So I kind of, there are things about it that that's why it's hard for me to completely dismiss it. Because I do think the scene when he's drunk is like probably next to Reverend Kane, the scariest thing about that movie, because Craig T. Nelson actually in those scenes is really phenomenally disturbing.
Yeah.
And then of course we get the Kane worm that he vomits up, which again I'm like,
Right.
oh my God, never drink the worm in tequila, lesson learned. So I was like, okay, you know, but nothing else. Poltergeist has given me a lot of life lessons, all the movies. So never move into downtown Chicago sky rises, you know. Minimize mirrors, you know.
I remember my brother seeing Poltergeist 2 before me and describing the worm sequence to me. And I remember even as a kid being like, wait, what? That's what happens in that movie? Like, I saw Poltergeist. How do we get from that movie to this? Even
We
as
go
a
from
kid.
face ripping to worms? You know, how do we
Right?
do
It makes no
that?
sense. Yeah, I don't know at what point it's appropriate to get into the controversy of Poltergeist. And part of me kind of doesn't want to, but I also feel like we're not really doing our job if we ignore it. Although that's my gut says ignore it because the less we talk about it, the less it's perpetuated. But I don't see how anybody could watch the scares in this movie or even the geography that you were talking about in that shot that goes through the family and to Oliver Robbins on the stairs. Not that Spielberg isn't great with geography and camera blocking, he's probably literally the best at it. But if you go back and watch The Funhouse or even the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like Tobe Hooper is no slouch in these areas. I think I said the only thing I remember saying when we did our live show on this movie was if you were to swap out the Jerry Goldsmith score or watch Poltergeist with the sound off, I think you would have a much easier time accepting, if not believing, that this is a Tobe Hooper movie.
I yes Which is funny because I'm actually watching it right now with the sound very low, so I get it.
it.
Because I don't want to bleed over to our audio. It's such a bummer for me because there are so many things about this, especially like going back and watching like Eaten Alive and revisiting some of Toby's like earlier stuff in terms of like eggshells and things like that. Like, yes, there's always, I mean, it's produced by Spielberg, especially like in the 80s, there were these earmarks of anything that Spielberg touched. And so I get it. And I get that feeling of like, oh, this is just Spielberg via Toby Hooper. And Toby didn't really have much creative insights or anything like that. But I don't agree because originally this was supposed to be a movie about aliens. This wasn't even supposed to be a supernatural movie. And that was something that Toby, pitched to Steven himself, where he didn't actually think the alien aspect of it was all that scary, but he thought bringing supernatural entities into it, not just like a ghost possession, ghost story type of movie, but something else, would actually inherently make it that much scarier for audiences, which I think he was dead on with that.
Yeah.
And, Steven was very busy doing ET and was spending time on the sets for Poltergeist, but
Sure.
like there's more people than not saying that no, Toby directed this movie. Like I
Right.
know Zelda Rubinstein, like I guess did some interview like 15 or so years ago, where she kind of laid into Toby, and I don't. I went back and reread it when I was writing my chapter just because I wanted to get a little context. And she was just saying like that Steven was there most of those days. And I think there was probably part of Toby that was intimidated working within like the confines of like a studio movie system at this level, getting to collaborate with somebody like Spielberg at this point in his career, because he really was kind of the rock star of 80s like movie making. You know what I mean? Like everybody wanted to work with Steven Spielberg. Whether he was producing your stuff or you were producing for him as a director, like he was the guy.
Yeah.
And so that was probably intimidating. And Toby isn't a very loud or forward guy, which we know just from like watching interviews with him and hearing people sharing stories about him. And so I think there is a lot of this that does feel perfectly in the wheelhouse of Amblin movies in general. I mean, there's aspects of this, like you could pair it up directly with ET and you're like, oh yeah, like these two stories can be taking place in the same subdivision on opposite sides and I would believe it. And I know that they were filmed in different subdivisions, so I know that's not necessarily the case, but it feels like they could very much be happening almost simultaneously because they share a lot of sort of similar DNA visually. Because they are stories about like these things coming into suburbia and how do we contend with those forces that we're not necessarily used to dealing with. And in ET, it's aliens and the US government. So I don't know. Like, and the thing is also, too, like, Steven doesn't owe any, never owed anybody anything. Do you know what I mean? He doesn't strike me as somebody who would just hand out credit because he feels bad either. And so when he did the letter, because I know he had to do like a letter in like the Hollywood, he didn't have to. He just did a letter in the Hollywood Reporter because the DGA decided to open up an investigation because heaven forbid Toby Hooper made a movie of this caliber. And like, it just feels all kind of bullshitty to me.
It is. I think, it's another Mandela thing where people have heard it repeated so often that it's just people who don't know any better automatically say, well, that's a Steven Spielberg movie. And he wrote it and he produced it and was a very hands-on producer. And so there are a lot of reasons why it resembles a Steven Spielberg movie. Obviously, you should go and find like the Mick Garris podcasts where he talks about
Yes.
this controversy because he really is the one who was there and can sort out the misunderstanding for people, if you are at all interested in that. I think, in most cases, I think people have their minds made up, and it's like you and me saying this is clearly a Toby Hooper movie isn't going to change anyone's mind who thinks it's a Steven Spielberg movie. But Toby Hooper is a little bit of victim of Poltergeist's success, both artistically and commercially. Because it is one of his best movies, because it was his most successful studio movie. and he never made another movie that was as successful or even really successful again, that people are like, well, clearly he didn't do that one because that one was a hit and that one people like, and people don't really dig on Life Force and people don't really dig on Mortuary, you know, like he made. And that's a function of the business changing and his budgets shrinking and unfortunately the fucking Poltergeist controversy sort of blacklisting him in Hollywood. I mean, he gets signed to a Canon deal after this, but once those movies fail to hit, he has a difficult time getting stuff made for the rest of his career. And I think those movies people point to and say, well, how could the guy who made, you know, fucking Crocodile or whatever, you know, what feels a little bit like a sci-fi movie, how could that be the same guy who made Poltergeist? And it's like, well, it was a different business. He was working at a different budget level. He was a different filmmaker at that point. There's all kinds of reasons why the same guy made a really good movie and a really less good movie. It happens literally every day. But I just wish that people would stop passing on this bullshit rumor over 40 years later without really knowing at all what they're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I have a there's a few different points I have on this topic. One, I think there could be something said to be said for that. I wish post Poltergeist, I wish there had been some other sort of hands-on producers that got involved with him, the way Spielberg got involved with him on Poltergeist. Because I think in a lot of ways, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but I think in some cases, like, Toby could be his own worst enemy.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
The fact that Texas Chainsaw was even finished and released is a miracle in itself 50 years later.
Yeah.
He seems like a guy who was really creative, understood sort of the visual language of how to convey horror and to scare people and to get under their skin. But I think he needed more people to sort of rein him in and to tell him no, or to help take his ideas and shape them in ways that maybe were more accessible now that we're making movies for mainstream audiences. But like, Life Force isn't a movie that you can show whatever the four quadrants or whatever bullshit people use now,
film
marketing, but Poltergeist is. And that's because he still could do what he was still telling a story that he wanted to, again, because he's the one who pitched going supernatural versus aliens, but he had structure. And I think honestly, a lot of our conversations about Toby Hooper's career post Poltergeist would have been a lot different had Toby found people he was comfortable working with that could give him a little structure.
Yeah.
Because you know what I mean? Because there's a lot of movies of his that I genuinely like, but there's like aspects from like, if you like just pull it in a little bit, but there's a disconnect. And I think in some cases, maybe creatively, he couldn't see the forest from the trees. And I think that might have been a little detrimental to him. I think I love that he worked with Canon. I love that Canon just basically handed him a bunch of blank checks and was like, go make his Texas Chainsaw 2 and whatever, and like, you're good to go. But I also wish somebody at Canon had been working there with him, not for Texas Chainsaw, but maybe for something for Life Force, or just in general, just to be like, hey, you want to make a movie about space vampires? Awesome. Maybe like, let's keep some of these things in mind. Because I just think that there was just something that really were always kind of worked against him. And it's such a bummer because like, I can see the through lines from Eggshells to this point. And it bums me out that people cannot. Right. Like, there are shots in Poltergeist that I'm like, it feels like the new wave of Texas Chainsaw. Like the shot when they're like at the cemetery and the white picket fence in the perfect, beautiful day. And Steven says something like, how could anybody have any problems on a day like this? And that's exactly what the day feels like at the start of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, when they pull over, you know, to go to the Hardesty Homestead. Like, that is a like a beautiful like composition. It just sets a really nice mood, and you're like, yeah, how could anybody have problems on a day like this? And I think that's like something really interesting that Toby was able to do in a lot of different ways. And then if you look at something like Eaten Alive and that visual style versus the Funhouse, both of those have sort of like this like insidious, like rotten kind of feeling to them with the way that they're shot. Almost feels like exploitative in a lot of ways, but I think it really reflects like those stories. So you cannot tell me that a director can be pigeonholed just from like one thing. Like there was multitudes to Toby, and I'm really excited. There is a lot of things I'm really excited to kind of go back and revisit, to kind of see them now in a different lens. I mean, I like even a few years ago when I rewatched The Mangler, that was not a movie that I genuinely liked when it came out. I went and saw it in theaters because I was like, Toby Hooper, Stephen King, let's do it, Robert Englund. But when I rewatched it a few years ago, I had a much better appreciation for it. And I'm even more so excited to go get it to do it for this because I'm like, I bet it's going to click even more because now we're kind of contextualizing these through lines in Toby's career. I mean, honestly, I really feel like we should do the pilot of Freddy's Nightmares.
I'm down.
Okay, because I really think that there's stuff in that too, in terms of like, you know, parental outrage in suburbia, this thing, like it's sort of surrealism that kind of ties into like eggshell sexist dreams. I think there's a lot there too.
Yeah.
So
I think there's a learning curve with Tobe Hooper that there isn't necessarily with a lot of other horror filmmakers. And it's unfortunate that, when we talk about these histories or these legacies that box office is inextricably tied, that what we're really talking about is sort of the trajectory of Tobe Hooper's career. Because truth be told, when the dust has settled, like all that matters is the movies that we have left. And I wouldn't change necessarily the movies that we have left. I'm glad that we got pure, unfiltered Tobe Hooper for most of his career. But, had the Poltergeist controversy not happened, had he had a more hands-on producer to work with him on some stuff, like, yes, the movies probably would have been more successful, more accessible, and he would have had a better career commercially, and he probably could have been happier because I know he, was a fairly tortured guy because of all of this bullshit. So I wish that for him. Selfishly, I'm glad that we got the movies that we got. And I think in a lot of cases, which we're going to find as we look at a lot of this stuff, like these movies were just ahead of their time. The post-Poltergeist movies, like the Cannon trilogy or like The Mangler, I think now people can look at them within the broader context of being a Tobe Hooper movie or having other points of comparison, whether it's filmmakers who were influenced by Tobe Hooper, like Rob Zombie, whether it's other horror movies that have gone sort of as crazy batshit with the tone. I think now people have a better context to understand something like Life Force or The Mangler than they did in 1985 or 1995. And so, if we're going to make the case that like all that matters is the work, I'm glad that he got to make the movies that he got to make. But yes, I completely agree with you that like his career w maybe wouldn't have gotten fucked if a few big things were different.
Yeah, I agree. And I think also too, like it's one of those things like I don't know, maybe I'm just easier on movies than a lot of folks where like I know when there's a movie that I genuinely like freaking love, like I'm immediately on board and I will champion the shit out of that movie. But I know in a lot of those cases, like when most people hate it, in about 10 years everyone comes around. And we've talked about this a ton of times on like when we were doing Craven Craven, but it's like
Absolutely.
it seems like the 10-year window these days is what works for modern movies. But I will say what I love is when people can go back to these older movies now. I hate the fact that these movies from our childhood are considered older movies now. I don't like this at all. But It is really cool to me to like see people go back and discover movies and find new appreciation for them and not just dismiss them because they're old movies or whatever. Yeah, like it's just, I get it. To be honest, like I don't know that I care. Like I watched Siskel and Ebert growing up. I don't know that I cared that they actually liked or hated a movie when I was going to see a movie. And for me, you know, as somebody who used to be a critic, I'm not there giving my opinions because you should listen to me as some official metric of whether or not you should go see a movie. Frankly, you should just go see every movie and decide for yourself. But all I can do is give you my reactions and what I took away from that experience. So, you know, I don't know, like, I mean, I don't know that, was there any like post Texas Chainsaw 2 Toby movies that like got a positive reaction from critics?
His remake of Toolbox Murders got some, it didn't get a theatrical release. It was straight to video, but by then some of the horror websites were up and running and some of them were like, "Hey, Toby's back." But no, I mean, really nothing after Poltergeist, because even the Canon
Yeah.
trilogy didn't get particularly good reviews.
Yeah, it's just, it makes me feel sad because I think there's so much to appreciate about what Toby was able to bring to the table in so many different capacities, whether it is making something as wildly bizarre as Life Force or as so unexpected as Texas Chainsaw 2 was a follow-up to what the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre was, or something like Poltergeist, which was him working within the confines of somebody else's sort of universe, but also finding his own way to tell a story in his, in it. Like, I don't understand how you look at some of these shots and be like, oh no, that's totally a Toby way of doing it. Like when you go back and look at other things, like I don't know. It's all frustration.
No, and the fact that it got taken away from him, his greatest success got taken away from him, really, really sucks. You know, I think all the time about like if he was still alive, would I want to meet him? And there's part of me that says no, because I have no idea what I would say to him. And there's part of me that says yes, I would want to tell him how much I love his work. And then I'm like, okay, but everybody says that, right? You say that to every filmmaker, every actor, every famous person you meet. But I guess for in my mind, it's a little different with Tobe Hooper because he spent so many years being so maligned by the mainstream and even by horror fans who sort of rejected him and have dismissed so much of his work. Again, a lot of it is being reassessed because audiences have caught up to what he is doing. The Scream Factory Blu-rays for those Canon movies, I think, have gone a long way towards legitimizing those movies. So I'm so glad they put those out, or the Mangler, or you know, whatever. Any of these, you know, the Arrow release of Eaten Alive, any of these boutique Blu-ray companies putting out his movies have sort of forced people to take a second look and realize, like, oh, there's a lot of artistry here, and that Tobe Hooper is, in fact, a brilliant filmmaker who didn't always have the best material to work with, who didn't always have the proper budgets to work with, who didn't always have the resources he needed. When he had those things, he was capable of making fucking Poltergeist. And to take that away from him is completely unfair.
Yeah. Also, too, I just realized because we were talking about aliens and stuff like that, I realized that Robbie was kind of an extreme kid because he has an alien poster in his room,
Yeah, he does. He's hardcore.
which is kind of crazy. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the reality is like, out of almost every interview that's ever come out, everybody's always defended Toby as the guy who directed it. Yeah. Spielberg was there, like, because this was like, why isn't everybody up Chris Columbus's butt because Spielberg is on set of Goonies every day?
Or Richard Donner's. I mean, Spielberg literally shot second unit on Goonies.
Yeah. Was
And
it,
he
oh God, I'm sorry. Chris
Well,
Columbus
Chris
is different.
Columbus
So
was
wrote
the
it.
writer. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, sorry. I keep forgetting the trajectory. I'm like, no, what? That's right. That was Richard Donner. I'm
Yeah.
sorry.
No, that's okay.
Put me in film jail.
Spielberg shot some second unit shots on Poltergeist the day that a journalist was there, and that's how this whole fucking bullshit rumor got started.
Yeah, because he was shooting the race cars, I think, in the beginning. Oh
Yeah.
my gosh.
Right.
Stop the presses. Meanwhile, they never talked about the fact that Toby was in another place shooting something else.
Exactly.
But, you know, Spielberg wanted it because he's a kid at heart. Like, I've
Right.
seen it in all, like, the BTS footage from Goonies. Like, this guy loved to be on set, loved to be, like,
That's why he
around kids
wanted
and
to shoot
stuff.
second unit on Goonies, because he was like, "Oh,
Yeah.
I'm one of the kids. I'll hang around with them."
Exactly. So I don't understand. I just don't understand why, like, I mean, I guess at that point, Donner was more established, I suppose, but still, like, I don't know. Damn Hollywood media.
It all sucks, and I just anytime I tweet out something about Tobe
There's
Hooper
always one,
or
right?
Poltergeist, there's at least one. And at this point, sometimes it's one just to piss me off. Other times it's people that just really believe that and refuse to educate themselves or refuse to accept any other possible truth. And it's real fucking frustrating, you know, from horror fans who should know better.
Yeah. And I've seen McGarris go after a lot of folks over the years too. So he is definitely a champion of Toby's. And we owe him that debt
Yeah, for
because,
sure.
you know, at least Mick's out here fighting a good fight.
Right.
And how do you argue with somebody with hair as luscious as that? Like, come on.
And who was fucking there? Like,
Exactly.
I wasn't there. You weren't there. These idiots on Twitter weren't there. Mick Garris was there, was on set, and knows what he's talking about. So I don't, you know, I get it that, like, John Leonetti's brother went on Shockwaves once and said, like, oh, yeah, John said that, Spielberg directed Poltergeist. And once
Oh.
that happened, it became like all the evidence that anyone needed. Because some guy's brother once said, you know what I mean? Like, that's
Did we
proof.
not, do you not learn anything from like growing up as teenagers? We're like, oh, my friend said like this. Like,
Right,
so it's
right.
obviously true. Like, did nobody learn anything?
Right.
Like, I literally don't give a shit what a guy, like a, you know, a brother of a friend of a, another friend of a brother. Like, I don't care. Were you there? No? Okay, then shut up.
Right.
You know, I genuinely don't care.
Mick Garris was
So,
there.
but
So go listen to Mick Garris.
exactly. I mean, you should listen to Mick Garris anyways. Like, I know post-mortem is over, but you should go
Yes.
back and listen because he also has like some really good interviews with Toby as well.
Yeah, for sure. You know what else you should listen to is us talking about Life Force. Is that what's next?
Life Force, is Life Force next?
Yeah.
Was it really 3 years?
That's wild.
What?
Well, I know a couple movies that he tried to get off the ground. Some of them happened between Eaten Alive and The Fun House. Like, there was a movie called The Dark that he quit. There was a movie called Venom that he quit. Yeah, I think it was 3 years between Poltergeist and Life Force that we're talking about now, which is insane. He
Wow.
made
Okay.
a Billy Idol video, like, in between.
Did I watch it recently too when I
Yeah,
was yeah, Dancing with Myself shows up a lot on Vevo.
Bevo on your sling.
A Vevo on my sling. I get very excited. Are you kidding? I love when that stuff comes up. That's crazy. Also too, if genuinely Steven Spielberg wasn't keen on Tobe Hooper as a director and didn't think he was capable, et cetera. Why the hell would he have him come back and work on his TV show?
Right.
And actually, I
And if
think.
he was just looking for a director to push around, like, maybe a guy who's already kind of a brand name like Tobe Hooper isn't the guy to push around.
Yeah.
You could find an anonymous TV director or something who could easily put his name on your film and let you direct it. Tobe Hooper
Yeah.
was a guy with artistry and vision and not somebody that you come and railroad. Whatever. We're preaching to the
Rah.
choir, I know,
Rah, 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 rah.
but
Keep my
so
rumblings.
as excited as I've been to talk about this first batch of movies, because they're the ones that we get real excited and passionate about. I'm weirdly excited to talk about like the back half of his catalog because it doesn't really get talked about, and because I know some of them I don't think you've seen, and because these are movies that I think need champions more than, say, Poltergeist and the Funhouse.
Very true. Very true. Like I've been in the trenches for Poltergeist for most of my life, but I'll
Yeah.
be really honest. I don't know that I have seen anything of his past, the Mangler, other than Masters of Horror. Maybe we should do an episode on his two Masters of Horror episodes as well.
Absolutely, we should.
Yeah, but I have not seen Crocodile. I have not seen Toolbox Murders or Mortuary or Jit.
Have you seen Night
So.
Terrors?
I see Night Terrors.
You would
Was
remember if you saw
that
Night Terrors.
with Robert Englund, right?
Correct, playing the Marquis de Sade.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen it since high school.
Okay.
But yes. It's getting a Blu-ray or something re now, right? Or
Is it?
something
Not
coming
that I've
out.
heard. I feel like people would have sent me that.
Yeah, I feel like I saw something about this recently. And that's not one that people talk about a whole lot.
It has no physical release right now. I don't even think there's a DVD.
Oh, interesting. I know. I think we heard from somebody, and I apologize if I'm forgetting who this is, but they talked about how Spontaneous Combustion has been on Tubi lately.
Yeah.
I'm like, so I might actually like, I'm afraid it's going to go away. So I'm like, I'm almost thinking like, oh, should I go ahead and watch that now? Just so that way I don't
Yeah,
lose my
right.
access to it because I don't have it.
Well,
And
we
that's
could
again one
always.
that I haven't, yeah, that's one I haven't seen since, oh gosh, junior high maybe. I
Okay.
feel like I was in like eighth grade and I was at somebody's house and it was on like cable or something, but it was like really late. I don't think I saw the whole thing either.
Well, you could always
So,
watch it and we could record the episode and bank it and then just run it, at the time that we need
oh,
to.
maybe, yeah, maybe we should just in case, because I'm afraid.
Right. Be
Because
afraid.
I think that's another, yeah, be afraid, be very afraid. Just because I think, I don't know that one, does that one have a physical release too or no?
It actually has a couple. There was a Code Red Blu-ray that came out, and then another company also put it out, MVD or somebody. I think you
Oh,
could
okay.
find it pretty cheaply, but I'm not encouraging you to do that because it might not be your jam.
Okay, well, we'll see.
Yeah.
I don't mind buying movies.
No, it's that's those are fun to buy. It's that other shit that I don't like groceries and
Yeah,
healthcare.
groceries. Oh, the worst.
Anyway,
Who
thank you
needs?
everybody for listening to. Oh, sorry, go. Who needs what?
Nothing. It was a dumb joke, and I talked over you, and I apologize.
That's okay. Thank you everybody for listening to us talk Poltergeist. Thank you, Heather, for espousing waxing poetic on your favorite Toby Hooper. We will be back next month with a discussion of Life Force, space vampires, Naked Matilda May. Steve Railsback going fucking crazy. Patrick Stewart having a homoerotic kiss. London falling to pieces. And of course, the great Toby Hooper. On behalff of my horror BFF, Heather, thank you very much for listening. And we will see you guys next month. Thanks, Heather.
Thank you, Patrick.